It's the Popmatic Podcast for October 5th, 2016.
This is one of the last paintings Titian ever did. And it's one of the greatest paintings in the world. At first sight, overwhelmed by the beauty of those gleaming bodies in that autumnal wood. And then, shock. Because what we're looking at is a scene of torture.
Coming to you from a box of broken crayons, it's the Popmatic Podcast, where you can be sad, but also rock out with your library card out. I'm Burnt Sienna, and joining me today are...
Amanda.
Mag.
Sarah.
Bale.
Umber. I'm Umber.
Burnt Umber or just Umber?
Oh, I'm Burnt Umber. Nice. Blackened.
It's time once again for the best portmanteau since Marcom. That's right, Arttober is here. We're going to treat you to a series of shows celebrating all things art for the next few weeks. We're starting this week with the visual arts for your eyeballs, followed by the culinary arts for your mouth hole, and then musical arts for your ear holes. So get pumped to talk about all kinds of arts. Hey, Sarah.
Yes.
Do you have some sort of local spin on this show topic this week?
Perhaps. It's funny to think of a library as an art gallery or piece of artwork itself, but that's one of the things I love about this building. How there's art to enjoy almost everywhere you go in the building, even in the bathrooms.
I don't know if I want to see that art.
I was going to say, what we call abstract art.
That's outsider art. Touch butt, get bacon.
Art that you need bleach
some infectious medium.
I don't know what touch bud get bacon beads, but it makes me laugh.
Oh, the sign on the hand dryer.
Sure.
It's like,
oh,
it's,
yeah.
Like someone, what well, someone, so it says like push button.
Right.
Okay. And so like someone makes like, it say push butt, and then it shows wavy lines for air,
yes,
and then someone wrote bacon. Get bacon.
I like this.
Anyway, it wasn't me.
Can we invent a machine like that? Because that would be cool.
That'd be awesome.
I don't know about the butt part, but the bacon.
Anyway.
Depends on the butt.
Anyway, onward.
Boston butt.
Anyway, okay. Some of my favorite artwork from around the main downtown library include the Bronze Front Doors by Alan LeQuire, the La Storia de la Terra statue by the Kubak Wilmson team, located on the northwest side of the building, and lastly, the prints and illustrations created by Barry Moser, included in the Wilson collection. Barry Moser is an artist and illustrator, painter, printmaker, designer, and author, to name a few other professions, from right here in this old great state of Tennessee. Chattanooga, to be exact. To highlight a bit of his impressive career, too, all of this according to his biography on his website, he graduated from a military academy in Chattanooga and then from Auburn in the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. He also completed some grad work at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. While I can't identify his exact area of artistic expertise, based on his rather lengthy and notable resume, I'm assuming a lot of his works are illustrations or literary related. Outside of the about 6 books he's illustrated in the Wilson Collection, he has works spread out in many museums and libraries throughout the world, including the Met, the National Gallery of Art in Washington, the British Museum, and even the Library of Congress. His work is rather unique and discernible, especially from the many styles of illustrations represented in the Wilson Collection. The predominant style he uses is wood engraving, which makes some of the pieces somewhat creepy, yet intriguing. Like the drawings he created for the Book of Revelations in the Pennyroyal Caxton Bible we have. Yeah, the devil picture is a bit haunting.
Cool.
Should check it out. Very wicked indeed.
Hail Satan.
Yes.
Because that was the point of Revelation.
Very devilish.
Yeah. The devil of the Bible. That's true.
Or his interpretation of the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland. It's not really smiling, but sort of looks like Mr. Beaglesworth from Austin Powers.
That,
Yeah.
In a woodcut?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. But that's what makes art great. Everyone has a different outlook and perspective that makes you see something from different eyes. As I already said, I believe there are about 6 books of Moser's in the Wilson Collection, and they represent the diversity of the presses included. LEC, which is Limited Edition Collection, Arion Press, and Moser's own Pennyroyal Press. On top of that, Moser donated to the library a woodblock he used when illustrating the Caxton Bible. So that's a pretty invaluable artifact.
Yeah.
So check out the website to make an appointment to view the collection sometime and see some of his artwork up close. You won't regret or forget it. Boo.
Surrealism, a 20th century avant-garde movement in art and literature that sought to release the creative potential of the unconscious mind, for example, by irrational juxtaposition of images. I would also like to include a movie in this, and the movie I'm talking about is Un Chien Andalou. That's translated into The Andalusian Dog. I much prefer Un Chien Andalou. It's directed by filmmaker Luis Buñuel and co-written by Mr. Buñuel and Salvador Dali. Ooh. You might ask, what's this movie about? I don't know. The movie starts out once upon a time. Then it goes to 8 years later, and it's only 21 minutes long. It's a movie or short film that was once described to me as you don't try to understand it, you dream it. The origin of the movie is supposedly Buñuel and Dali was having lunch one day, and Buñuel said, I had a dream in which a cloud sliced the moon in half like a razor blade, slicing through an eye. Dali told Buñuel about his dream, about hand crawling with ants, to which Buñuel replied, there's a film, let's go make it. So yeah. That's a lunch I would have liked to have been at. Yeah. So at the beginning, Luis Buñuel is the dude with the razor who's sharpening the razor. Un Chien Andalou is, like I said, 21 minutes. It's worth your time to watch. I would also like to recommend a book that we have in our system called Salvador Dali Masterpieces from the Dali Museum. Ooh. It's a great book to read and look at his art. For example, one of the portraits is Telephone in a Dish with 3 Grilled Sardines at the End of September. It talks about the painting and the history around the painting. I also wanted to say Telephone in a Dish with 3 Grilled Sardines at the End of September. And the funny thing about it, that's what it looks like. It's really strange. But anyway, it's good stuff.
I want to tell my surrealist joke. So how many surrealists does it take to change a light bulb?
A boy.
Oh boy, yeah.
So many.
A fish.
Good one.
Nice.
I like that one. I like that one.
I have like 2 jokes in my repertoire. That's one of them.
Dali Museum is amazing. I went there last year. I wore a t-shirt that had melted Daleks instead of the watches.
Nice. Nice.
Isn't that is it in Tampa?
It's in Florida.
St. Petersburg.
Yeah. That's what it is. Yeah.
And all the docents were just like, that shirt is amazing. I have to have it. I'm all like, oh, you know. Brushing my own shoulder. Yeah. Then I spent like $5 million in the gift shop.
Long time listener.
Sorry. Jeremy steals my purple tape. Every year around this time, I've noticed that friends, family, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Holy Mother Belcourt, and even my fellow podmates try to distract me from the reason for the season. Art, documentaries, dramas, blah. Everyone knows that fear reigns in Shocktober. This year, I couldn't take it anymore. I'll show them. I'll show them all. Thunder, thunder. So every week, I'm going to pull an Amanda and tie both segments together.
Nice.
Much like Dr. Frankenstein. Hey. Or at least make them both be horror-related. Except for possibly culinary arts. I'm not sure about that one. Anywho, this week, I'm going to talk about a little documentary called Dark Star, H.R. Giger's World. Hans Rudolf Giger, or Hans Rudy, as they keep calling him in the documentary, was a painter, sculptor, furniture designer, film director, and bar owner. Most famous for designing the titular alien of the movie, Alien. He's a xenomorph. I know. They don't call him that in the movie, do they? I don't know. He also designed the Alien Species and the really cool album cover for Emerson, Lake & Palmer's Brain Salad Surgery.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah. ELP.
Tarkus for life.
Oh, prog tainted. Oh, boy. His work combines both organic and mechanical bits. and tend to be in shades of gray or black. And it's mostly concerned with birth slash babies, naked women, and death. Wikipedia calls him a surrealist, even though they don't really say that in the movie. But I can kind of see it, though, because much like the surrealist, he didn't really, like, plan his paintings ahead of time. He just kind of, like, would just paint, you know, just kind of, like, throw it, you know, subconscious on cabinets. Revelation from the documentary is that he didn't really like horror at all. His works are kind of like therapy. Projecting his fears allowed him to overcome them. You know, at the beginning of the movie, he shows off, like, the first human skull, which he got from his parents that he owns. He's Swiss.
Oh, Swiss. Oh,
yeah. Okay. So he speaks German, but, like, as a person who spoke German for 3 years, he speaks this crazy guttural German. Yeah. That's just like, ah. The Swiss have their own, like, just crazy brand.
Swiss and German and French and Swiss.
The four official languages in Switzerland: Italian, French, German, and Latin.
People speak Latin still?
Ask the Swiss.
I met a guy from Switzerland. His name was Matthias Lindenberger, and he spoke French more than German. But
it depends on the area of Switzerland they live in. So horror fan Mike would have been like, cool, it's a skull. Look at my cool skull. Yeah. He was like, so I've got a skull.
I'm going to die someday.
You know, it's very cool. He dies at the end. Spoiler alert. Winning the Oscar for Alien changed his career forever. He went from a fairly obscure artist, little known outside of Switzerland, to becoming world famous, being able to buy an entire castle to house a museum devoted to his works. It's like the Schloss something other in, like, Gruyere. It's like, oh, fancy. The documentary primarily focuses on the last 2 years of his life, except for a scene in one of his bars, a scene where he dedicated the H.R. Giger Museum, and a scene at the farm from where he grew up. Most of the film is at his gigantic house in Zurich, complete with a kind of haunted house, like, or haunted, what is it, those?
Whatever. Maze.
Yeah, like a maze in the backyard, filled with spooky sculptures, complete with its own amusement park-esque, like, rail car. Like, there's a grown man in this itty-bitty rail car going on this rail, and, like, you know, doors filled with skulls and, like, you know, iron bars that, like, open up and, like, let him in. And it's like, he's cramped in this itty-bitty car. It's, like, really silly looking. You know, when his like, current wife is like, I met him when he installed the rail car, and then they show him on this itty-bitty car. It's great. The downside of the documentary is that there's very little devoted to, like, his whole life. You know, most of these kind of biographical docs have, like, a slice of life bit, but they also, like, intermingle it with, like, you know, who they are and where they came from and, you know, their inspirations or whatever. But there's not really that much here, you know, like, they talk to, like, Ridley Scott, you know, and he's like, Dan O'Bannon handed me this book of H.R. Giger paintings. Whoa! But it's like, you know, if you've seen the Jodorowsky's Dune documentary, you know where Dan O'Bannon would have heard of him from, you know, or, like, they never mention about Species except for this one-handed comment. And I'm all like, oh, yeah, he wrote a Species. Oh, yeah. Anyway, but so dealing all my purple ticks. Soon Jeremy will become Mike, too. And then I can retire. You do, Shy Chobo. Take a nap.
That sounded more like me in some ways.
Whatever.
We're becoming the same person.
Yeah, if I say, like, book, like, weird, then I'll know that I've become everything. Everywhere the N's and K, you just have a different.
Really?
Yeah, it's very noticeable.
Great. I noticed that forever.
You will notice now. Ultimately, Dark Star H.R. Giger's world is for fans, but the paintings shown, you know, are super cool. It's really worth seeing if you like his stuff already. He worked for over 50 years.
Is it his painting that was in the Dead Kennedys record that got...
What originally followed here was a long, disinformation-filled ramble about a particular Giger painting that was included in a punk rock band's album, and it caused a lot of controversy. So here are the facts. The painting in question is H.R. Giger's work 219, Landscape 20, more popularly known as Penis Landscape. This was included as a poster in the punk rock band Dead Kennedys' 1985 album Frankenchrist. The band and the people at their record label were charged with obscenity for distributing this poster with their record. The incident received a lot of press. This was largely because Tipper Gore's Parents Music Resource Center considered the charges to be a victory. Ultimately, there was a hung jury, but the trial ended up bankrupting the band and led to the breakup of the Dead Kennedys. But at the time, it received a lot of press.
So, speaking of penis landscapes, what do you have, Amanda?
Well, Mike.
I could resist.
I would have mentioned it if I thought it was. That's why I mentioned it.
Penis landscape is a Geiger painting. It was created in 1973.
So I'm not totally off topic.
Ever since Lake of Palmer, I knew that one.
I knew that
one. Apparently you did a Deborah Harry cover.
Oh, yeah, totally. Speaking of Deborah, Harry, what do you have, Amanda?
Yeah.
Not quite as good as Mike's segue.
I just thought it was more gentlemanly. I thought it was more gentlemanly.
So I consider myself a pretty creative person. And while I would say I'm a musician first, I would say artist is right there, you know, very close second place, because I've always loved to color and draw and paint and throw glitter at people. But it's hard. It's hard for me to... And probably for a lot of people, to imagine someone making their living by actually being an artist. For me, it's just a hobby for now. But for some folks, you know, it's really all they know how to do. And especially in this day and age, in my head, artists are old dead guys like Rembrandt or Monet or Hopper, you know, whose paintings hang in museums in big cities that people should go to. But PBS is helping to change all that. They started a television series in 2001 called Art in the 21st Century, which has subsequently been shortened to just Art 21.
That's what that means.
It's magic.
Trust me, gang, we have tons of those.
Yeah, we do.
Spoiler alert.
So this show features many practicing artists in a wide range of media, from sculpture to painting to architecture to performance art. And I have to say, I haven't liked all of the artists that have been showcased. A few were just downright weird.
Mike might like them. Yeah, weird. Yeah, tell me more.
But I can respect their process, and I really was amazed at how they just kind of put themselves out there. Now, the format of the show features three artists under kind of a one-word overarching theme. Some examples of these words include, like, identity or paradox or compassion. And one of my favorite aspects of the show is then how each artist kind of approaches this topic differently. Their viewpoints are always very different, very independent of each other. But as the episode progresses, you can see how they are related. And for example, in season 7, the final episode was called Fiction, and it had to do with how artists view life and reality when maybe it isn't quite exactly real. One of the artists actually spray painted trees and dirt. That was her media.
Oh, art.
Okay. It seems weird, but it was really cool how she kind of did it. So it's interesting with Art 21 because watching the show is kind of like eating your vegetables. So like when I see a new season has come out, the rational part of me thinks, oh, I should watch that. It'll be good for me. But the creative side of me thinks, oh, I don't want to watch it. I guess I think it's going to be boring or something. But then once I actually start watching it, I don't want to stop. Like, oh, don't let it in. I think it's because I don't come across working artists in my everyday life, and it's just captivating to watch their process. And like, it usually shows them in their studio and how they put their work together. So the library recently ordered season 8, so you can put that on hold. They do currently have seasons 1 through 7 that you can get started on today. One weird little note, we only have season 5 in book form for some reason. Apparently there was an issue, but I think it works just as well as the show. This is a visual medium after all, so you just have to put a little more work into it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Does anybody do like little bushes and stuff like the dauber?
We don't have happy trees that I have seen, except for the big one that they spray paint and put dirt around and spray paint in. But one guy that like all he did.
We went on a Bob Ross tangent at some point.
Yeah. We did. That one of the artists on season 7 collected pollen and then like he sprinkled it into big boxes like on floors of places and like that was his artwork. Like it showed him like sprinkling it through a sieve. He made the big yellow box and it was called like Pollen 27. Yeah, I was like, he's like, well, this pollen was collected in the south of France in 2002. And I was like,
okay,
who pays for that? That's one of those I wasn't really impressed with.
The sneezes that it elicits in people.
I'm getting a reaction from my work.
I'm getting an allergic reaction.
That's exactly.
It's the sand paintings. Don't sneeze unless you sneeze for this section.
Oh, man.
That's excellent.
Oh, mandala.
Wow.
That was not good. I'm just going to let
I like that one.
Jesus Christ. Accident. Contrarian, what's it get?
I come across a working artist in my everyday life, and she took
took
a gouge out of our table the other day when she was carving out some letters on a.
She meant to do that, right? Artistic expression.
Oh, no, she didn't mean to do that. She was like, oh, she said a word that ended in K, and it sounded weird if I said it.
Whoa.
Really? Oh, my. Fire truck?
Yeah, fire truck. Fire truck.
Melon farmer.
No, it was fine. Today, I wanted to talk about a couple of books that I return to probably a couple times a year, every year. I keep coming back to these books because they contain kind of a certain kind of artistic magic, which could have been easily lost to time and never given a wider audience if they weren't noticed by whoever put these books together. The first is called Extreme Canvas Hand-Painted Movie Posters from Ghana. I just mentioned here that my wife is a printmaker, and so posters have a special place in my heart, like lots of American teenagers. My bedroom was covered in posters when I was a young man for bands and movies and comic books that I liked, and I still have several of those rolled up in tubes in my basement. The posters in this book, though, are not like their slick cousins that you see in multiplexes across America or in teenage bedrooms. Like the title says, these were hand-painted on canvas and stretched and hung outside of makeshift movie houses in the African nation of Ghana between 1975 and 1998. There's a picture of one of these movie places, too. They call it a video club, and it is an open-air place with rows of wooden benches with a small television set up on a pedestal, and you can see the ocean in the background, and there's a fishing net that they drop over the TV when they're not showing movies, and it's like a drive-in, and they turn the movie on after sundown, and that was the movie house. So a lot of the movies that they were seeing were not first-run blockbuster films. So the posters and paintings in the book are like someone played telephone with the existing posters of movies for things like Crawl, I Spit on Your Grave, Bad Girls Dormitory, all the American Ninja movies, anything with Chuck Norris made between 1975 and 98. Yeah, it is amazing. The artists play really fast and loose with human anatomy, and the images they conjure are like Hieronymus Bosch art directing the VHS boxes for Canon Films releases. It's incredible. And there are little profiles of the artists in the back, and I want to give each of them a hug. The other book is called, and I think I've talked about this before because there was a art show featuring art from this book in Washington, D.C. sometime in the last couple of years. It's called Mingering Mike, The Amazing Career of an Imaginary Soul Superstar. So sometimes you go to a record store and like the cover is so good, you just want to hear it. Sort of like you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover.
And it's always garbage.
But then you're like, oh, this is horrible. So this is not a problem with the work of Mingering Mike. These records have no music, just glorious artwork for non-existent records like 1970s Channels of a Dream and 1972's Sickle Cell Anemia. So how this artwork was found is sort of tailor-made for an NPR driveway moment. There's a criminal investigator / DJ named Dori Hadar who went crate digging at a Washington, D.C. flea market looking for records. He found a treasure trove of record sleeves that were filled with cardboard records, and then each had hand-drawn artwork, hand lettering, liner notes, recording info. Some of them were even shrink-wrapped. And so using his detective skills, Dori Hadar tracked down this Mingering Mike person that created it. And then the book is the story of the imaginary world created by a lonely music-loving boy in the 1960s and 70s. So it's kind of like got a Henry Darger thing to it. You know, like his work wasn't discovered till after he died. I love it. I love like the razor's edge of like, oh, this could have just been thrown in the trash by somebody, but thankfully someone found it, and then also this guy's still alive to talk about it, and that's great. And that's kind of what both of these books are. Like, I don't know if these posters in Ghana were exactly valued for their artistic value, but they really are amazing. And the same thing with Mingering Mike, and I can't recommend them both highly enough. Hey guys.
Hey Jeremy.
What's up, Jeremy?
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well
maybe the library
has it.
Maybe the library doesn't. But either way,
it's tickling our fancy.
Amanda?
All right, so I blame The Big Bang Theory for my interest in Stephen Hawking.
Bazinga.
The TV show, not the astrological phenomenon. Thank you.
I saw you italicized it.
Yes. So I knew who Hawking was before the show, and his A Brief History of Time has been on my smart people reading list for a minute now.
Yeah, same.
But it wasn't until the escapades of Sheldon and Leonard that I realized how unlikely it will be for me to actually read A Brief History of Time and, you know, understand it.
Yeah.
It's kind of the Alan Turing book all over again.
I bought that book at a book fair in seventh grade. Like, I'm going to read this book.
I'm going to be smart. Yeah. And I should feel like I should know this.
I'm going to read the X-Men.
I understand all the words, but I don't know how they go together.
Yeah. That's too many words that are not words, but like symbols.
But recently I stumbled across another PBS series that actually features Stephen Hawking. It's called Genius.
The simple premise of the show is that Hawking asks broad but important scientific questions like, is time travel possible? Are we alone? Or who are we? And then walks three volunteers through several hands-on experiments to help them answer the question for themselves. Now, his idea is that everyone can think like a genius. The volunteers are different on every show. It's usually a different combination of boys and girls. I should say men and women. They're our age. The volunteers, and they have to work together to discover the answer. Now, by nature, I'm a very Socratic learner and teacher. It's too easy to just give someone the answer when they ask you a question. But if you ask them leading questions designed to direct the learner to their goal, that is what I think is the best way to teach someone. So Hawking's methodology was right in my wheelhouse. And I think that's why I enjoyed the episode so much. Sometimes I was faster than the volunteers and figured it out. Sometimes I wasn't. But I did stay engaged in each show. My favorite moment was in one experiment. There was a ping pong ball that got suddenly and surprisingly blasted with a geyser of fire.
Yeah.
I mean, like, eyebrows were in jeopardy. It was awesome. Hawking really did pull out all the stops. Like, he rents a theater for one group of experiments about space. And so, I mean, it really was high class. But in the efforts of full disclosure, there were about two episodes that were a little bit more evolutionary based than my creationist brain cared for. But Hawking does treat any kind of religion or faith with respect. He even goes so far at one point as to say God does not intervene to rig the laws of nature.
Of course.
So faith and science do not have to be mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
Now, I do not consider myself a scientific person, but I did find these six episodes to be fascinating. The show aired on PBS this past summer, but now you can check out the DVD from the library and start thinking like a genius for yourself, because like Hawking says, you are smarter than you think.
Speaking of smarter than a fifth grader. Sorry.
Maybe Mike's smarter than you think.
Not based on what I'm about to recommend.
Jeff Foxworthy.
You might be a redneck joke.
He's from Georgia like you are.
He is. My sister bumped into him at a grocery store once.
Of course she did.
She was running through there trying to get pet food, and she literally smacked into Jeff Foxworthy. And was like, where are you going?
Literally bumped into him.
Where's the fire?
You can't walk and carry pet food at the same time. You might be a redneck.
Pay attention to him.
If you have a working television that sits on top of a non-working television...
My favorite one is that
from Kentucky.
You stare at the orange juice because it says concentrate. That's my favorite one.
He looks like a mammal with a mustache, that guy.
Poor Jeff Foxworthy. Really?
Hey, he's made of money. I think he's totally fine.
So he can wear whatever he wants.
Yeah,
he's made his fortune.
Yet still lives in Atlanta. last week, I recommended a horror book / series that took me about 2.5 weeks to read. Today, I'm going to recommend a horror novel that took maybe 2 hours tops. It's called The Visible Filth.
Ooh.
I didn't write its last name. His first name. Oh, no. First last name is Bellingrund. I think it's...
Oh, it's Nathan.
Yes. It's about a bartender who's just unlucky at relationships. Spoiler alert. As the story progresses, you gradually find out that he's kind of a...
Well, that word ends in a K, and I think it's not allowed on the podcast.
He's kind of a penis. He has...
like one penis or a whole
landscape.
Yeah, right. He's a massive canvas of penises.
It's an automatic insult.
This is the censored episode.
You, sir, are a canvas of penises.
Such a great insult.
Oh, well, anyway, bartender guy has a crush on a girl who's just a regular at his bar. He wants to get out of the friend zone, but just can't seem to get out of that extra step. One night, a violent bar fight breaks out, and one of his patrons dies. After being questioned by police, he notices that someone left a cell phone in the scuffle. But it's weird because both fighters were dudes. This appears to be a woman's phone covered in silly flowers and such. It's pink. What he sees on the phone is pretty shocking even to me. I'll leave it there. It's a brisk 68 pages. You could get freaked out in an afternoon. It's great. We don't have it, and it's not in a lot of libraries, so you can't ILL it. Probably not. I didn't try. But I would buy it if I were you. We do have his book, North American Lake Monsters, on Overdrive, which I'll definitely be reading later this month.
We also have a physical copy of it.
It just said ebook when I looked at it, but okay.
It's true, I've checked it out before. I didn't get around to it.
It was so scary, you did not read it. Yes.
I'm more of a South American lake monster myself.
Person.
Well, on that Venezuelan note, what do you have, Sarah?
All right. Speaking of visual arts, I'm going to keep this theme going. Centennial Park recently had a new addition to its grounds, a monument commemorating Nashville's pivotal role towards women's suffrage. Fun stuff. Created by already mentioned above and successful Nashville sculptor Alan LeQuire, the monument includes five women important to the suffrage movement, including Anne Dallas Dudley. They were all present for the final ratification battle in 1920. Dudley's significance, a.k.a. why I mentioned her name specifically, is because in May 1916, a long time ago, she led a parade that allegedly started at the Capitol building to Centennial Park to show support for women's suffrage. According to record, it is known to be Nashville's largest women's suffrage rally. A lot of women. The mayor at the time even declared a holiday for the day. Tennessee was a crucial state for women's suffrage in the United States because after all other southern states rejected the proposed amendment, shocker, Tennessee did not and became the deciding vote to ratify the 19th Amendment. How you like them apples?
Wow. This gives my vote. How do you like them apples? The best one.
I got her vote. How do you like them apples?
There you go. But back to the monument.
Oh.
It was unveiled a month ago on Women's Equality Day, August 26th. The grandchildren of Dudley evidently spoke at the unveiling as well, and this makes the second piece of work for LeQuire stationed in Centennial Park, the first being Athena Parthenos in the Parthenon.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
And I guess for this podcast's sake, I checked it out last night, went over and visited after work, in between avoiding a group of women running around getting yelled at by this large man. I was able to check it out. It's pretty cool.
Look how far you've come, ladies.
Yeah.
It's deadly.
Exactly. It's a bit ironic.
You can vote, but men are still horrible.
Precisely. And another quick recommendation, if you're feeling empowered and curious, there's a movie you should check out from the library about the women's suffrage movement in Great Britain. It's called Suffragette, and it stars women warriors Carey Mulligan, Meryl Streep, and Helena Bonham Carter. Quite a cast indeed.
Women should not exercise judgment in political affairs.
If we allow women to vote, it will mean the loss of social structure.
Vote for women!
You work at the laundry?
Part-time from when I was 7, full-time from when I was 12.
We meet Mondays and Thursdays if you're interested.
You a suffragette, Mrs. Elliot?
I consider myself more of a soldier.
As Mrs. Pankhurst says, it's deeds, not words, that will get us the vote.
We've identified weaknesses in their ranks. We're hoping one of them will break.
They're saying she's to speak.
This is a deliberate escalation. This has to stop.
For 50 years, we have labored peacefully to secure the vote for women. We've been ridiculed, battered, and ignored.
Punish those responsible, whatever way you can.
Mama!
All my life, I've done what men told me. Well, I can't have that anymore.
Took my love, took it down.
I incite the women in Britain to rebellion.
Can I sail through the changing ocean tides? Can I handle the seasons of my life?
We break windows. We burn things. Because war's the only language men listen to.
Well, I've been afraid of changing.
There's nothing left but to stop you.
We're in every home, we're half the human race, you can't stop us all.
But time makes you bolder, even
changing. You might lose your life before this is over.
I'm getting older too.
We will win.
And one last message to leave you with, and I know Amanda will back me up here. It's important to know who run the world.
Girls.
That's right.
We run the world. We run this mother.
Girls, we run this mother. Yeah.
We run the jewels. I don't know what that means.
I don't know what that's a band.
That's
right?
A band. I don't know anything. Yeah. I don't know anything about that.
Bill? The show Making a Murderer on Netflix is all the rage. In this 10-part documentary, it shows how Steve Avery was set up by law enforcement for rape and murder of a woman by the name of Teresa Albach. Now, I haven't watched the entire, I'm five episodes in. But wait a moment, I've just listened to an audio book called Indefensible, The Missing Truth About Steve Avery, Teresa Albach, and Making of a Murderer by Michael Griesbach, which tells you some very interesting facts about Steve Avery that the Netflix documentary conveniently left out. The book or audio is called Indefensible, once again, The Missing Truth About Steve Avery, Teresa Albach, and Making a Murderer by Michael Griesbach. And it will make you look at the documentary with jaded eyes, to say the least.
Please just punch that. Somebody enjoyed that book because it took me half an hour to catalog it because it had the worst record ever. So, I remember specifically because there was no print copy that I could see.
Well, it's kind of a nice companion piece. If you're listening to it, you go home and watch it.
Everybody
and you see this stuff that he's pointed out that they're not pointing out.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you look at the website and see everything there, I wrote it. Hi, Mike. It's art. What do you got, Jeremy? I control the horizontal. I control the vertical.
Outer limits.
Yeah. That's right.
Awesome. So this is kind of a standby, tickle my fancy kind of thing, but I have talked about Stephen King. We've talked about Stephen King before. I've been slowly working my way through the novella collection, different seasons, over the past few months. I'd wanted to read Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption again and then finish the book because I'd never done that and got slowed up by App Pupil, which is just really not that great. At least I didn't think so. Rita Hayworth is great. And then finally I got to The Body, which is the third collection in the story, and that is in the book. That's the basis for the film Stand By Me, and it is really, really good. He really does this sort of coming-of-age story really well. And then, like, you know, young people encountering some kind of darkness and then, you know, getting through it or whatever. It's really good. And also, I think I still have a little bit of a Stranger Things thing in my head. And so some young people going out and doing things was really interesting me lately. So
Didn't every story of that book become a movie?
I don't think The Breathing. No, I think it has, maybe. Didn't it?
I don't think The Breathing Method. Yeah.
I think maybe.
I could have sworn there was one of his books and novellas where all of them become movies.
Maybe
it's Four Past Midnight.
It may be. The Langoliers and Secret Window, Secret Garden.
Yeah.
I don't know. No, that's the dog. I don't know. Maybe not. Mm.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, most of those have been. Because, yeah, At Pupil's a movie.
Yeah, the story was like three times as long as it needed to be.
Yeah, it's not the way about the movie.
Yeah, not very good. Shawshank Redemption, great. The Body, great. They're similar.
What's the other story?
It's called The Breathing Method. It's a weird story about a pregnant lady. It's pretty odd. But I feel like maybe there was a movie that was made of it, but it was like kind of didn't do anything. But
we'll do some fact checking.
Yeah. Future Corrections.
Yeah, Future Corrections.
Oh, that's my favorite kind.
The Breathing Method was not made into a film, but the rest were.
Okay. Yeah. Present correction.
So,
nice.
Yeah, send Stephen King a dollar and make a movie called The Breathing Method, and then finish this mother. Let's do this.
Let's do this.
Is it worth becoming a movie?
Yeah. Sure.
That's never stopped Hollywood.
It's like The Shining. Ow! Sick burn!
If you could make a movie as good as The Shining...
Hey, you know,
out of The Breathing Method, then
if he has his dollar babies, you know, I mean, all you have to do is give him a dollar, and you know, if you can make it within, I think, a year or two, like you can make any movie you want.
I'd buy that for a dollar. Corrections. Who has corrections this week?
I know.
No.
I felt guilty for spoiling Fahrenheit 451. No. Other than that, you know.
Don't feel guilty for spoiling a 50-plus-year-old.
Yeah, if you haven't read it by now, it's on you.
Norman, yeah, exactly. Seriously.
Yeah, Norman Bates dresses as his mom. It was Earth All Along.
Rosebud was a sled.
Yeah. Yeah. If you ruin that one, then
and they all did it on Murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah, I hear dead people. That's for the audiobook edition.
And it was a dude in The Crying Game.
Yeah.
Yes. That's excellent. If you listened to last week's show, you may have noticed that you might have heard the correction segment of the show before. Here to explain that is our editor, Evil Robot.
Well, I don't think there is any question about it. It can only be attributable to human error. This sort of thing has cropped up before, and it has always been due to human error.
For more information on the failures of artificial intelligence, you can go to
www.librarynashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
The show was edited by an evil robot.
You can subscribe to the Pop Mag Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and your RSS feed. Next week,
culinary arts.
Yeah.
Yum, yum. The Swedish chef.
Yeah, it's all going to be.
Can we do that the entire time?
Meatballs for everyone.
I'm just
going
to throw things.
Bird.
It's going to be 45 minutes of that. Evil Robot's going to have a field day.
Put the podcast in the Swedish chef generator. Yeah. That's my favorite filter ever.
Surrealism.
You mentioned young artists expressing themselves. Jello Biafra was taken to court a couple of years ago for the album Frankenchrist by the Dead Kennedys.
Well, what we're seeing here is what I see as a false controversy. It's rap music, and rap music is being cast as a Willie Horton poltergeist-type figure in order to advance the agenda of Tipper Gore's organization, the PMRC. In my case, I can relate to NWA's song About the Police, because after my record Frankenchrist was blasted by Susan Baker and the PMRC in Variety, 2 weeks later, 9 police officers, 3 from LA, 6 from San Francisco, broke a window by my front door, stormed into my house, tore the place apart like you'd see KGB people doing a TV movie or something, went through my address book page by page, comparing names, and while I sat there on a chair with a bathrobe on with 2 cops with their jackets zipped right up to about here so they might be packing a gun, circling around me like sharks. It was a subtle form of rape in a way. And then after a year, about, what was it, 2 months later, charges were filed against my record. A year and a half later, it finally came to trial. 3 weeks sitting in a courtroom in Los Angeles watching lawyers argue over not just the supposedly explicit insert by an Academy Award-winning artist from Switzerland, my lyrics were put on trial. A huge blow-up was brought in and was gone over by experts line by line. In the end, the jury did not agree with the allegations of the PMRC. They deadlocked 7-5 in favor of acquittal. But after the trial, in the paper called the Metro in Nashville, Tennessee, Tipper Gore was asked about my trial and said, quote, "I'd like to take credit for it. I accuse you of trying to destroy my career and ruin my right to make a living."
No.
Oh. Surrealism.
It's the flaying of Marcius. And then, as you look, you begin to understand that only Titian could make poetry out of such pain. The story was that Marcius, a satyr, half goat, half man, challenged Apollo, the god of song, to a musical contest. And they agreed that the victor could do what he liked with the loser. And Apollo decided to flay him alive. Narcissian understood what that meant. That to be an artist was to challenge the god, and of course to lose, and to have your skin taken off you, to be completely exposed, to have all of you put there for people to look at. And if you look at the face of Marcius, his arms are surrendered. Even though a little dog laps his blood, Marcius is ecstatic, because he knows this is proof that he has gone the whole way. And the fact that Titian knows that must have proved to Titian that he too had gone the whole way. The picture itself is his complete vindication.